History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned over the years is that they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week, the college football season kicks off, and that made me think of some of the veterans we've had on this show who had their college football careers interrupted by World War II. If you compare the game in 2021 with college football 80 years ago, the points of differentiation are plentiful. And the reality is many of America's best college football players gave their lives during World War II. Others were wounded, became prisoners, or experienced other life-altering turns. I went back through all the different college footballers we've interviewed over the years on Hometown Heroes, and I picked out three of them that I think you're really going to enjoy hearing from today. We'll start out with a guy who played in the same backfield at the University of Nevada with Hall of Famer Marion Motley, went on to fly P-51s in Europe, and spent 5 months as a prisoner of war before a long post-war career as a high school football coach and math teacher in Bakersfield, California. Jordan Eliadis, or Turk as he was known for most of his life, grew up in McGill, Nevada, and we pick up his story when he was wearing that Nevada Wolfpack jersey in December 1941.
When we were playing, I don't remember what game it was. It was near the end of our schedule at university. We had the situation where the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. A number of guys in the fraternity house, they went in the service right away. Some of the older guys, I don't know why. But anyway, when we declared war on Germany, I knew I was going to have to go. We had our next to the last football game, and after the football game, there was a couple of other guys, and we went to Sacramento to enroll. I thought flying sounded pretty good, so that's where we signed up.
Had you ever flown before?
No, never flown before. It was all new. We took a test. I think there were four of us. Two of them didn't make it on the exam. The next day we went and had a physical. I have never had a physical like that before. What they ask you to do and some of the things, which was a normal physical check, you know, all that. And one of the guys flunked out. I was the only guy that made it. When I went back, he said to me, "Well, you're in school. Don't worry about it. They're not going to call you for a long time or whatever." Anyway, it was in latter part of November when my dad got killed. And I was in school at the university, got home. Of course, I was very close with my high school coach. You know, I was the quarterback on the high school football team. But I never carried the ball. Occasionally, I would receive a pass. You were a blocking back. That's what you were on, that single wing. Is what you were. But when I got to University of Nevada, I want to tell you, I remember the first day we were dressing and Marion Motley was there. Oh, my gosh. I can't explain to you what a body. My God, he had to be 6 foot, but man, he was just like poured out that way. I want to tell you something. You'll think it's crazy. When our fullback, who was our blocking back, they had to do the blocking. You know who had to do the blocking? I had the block for those people. We played an army team here in town. I mean, there. And one of the guys I recognized, the name, because in the fraternity, it shows me tackling him. Of course, I didn't know who he was. When I got back here in Bakersfield, he was the head coach at Garces High School.
How about that?
I remember we talked about it and so on. It's all they could talk about was Marion Motley and so on.
Well, and maybe some younger listeners don't know the name Marion Motley, but this is a Pro Football Hall of Famer, one of the greatest athletes of the 1940s. And here he is, your teammate at the University of Nevada. And you were blocking for him?
When we played the Army team, I blocked for him that day. I remember the first time I went out to block that in, he must have hit me and knocked me after that. You know, most of those guys were all college guys. that were in the service. They had some top-notch people.
So that's what you did while you continued at the University of Nevada until you got called to active duty? You
right.
kept playing?
I remember the first mission I was into Germany. I was only 21 years old. Once we got into German territory, I remember saying to myself, there's no friends down there.
And what were your typical missions like? Are you guys flying low and strafing?
There's a place called the Zuider Zee. Mm-hmm. And we would meet the bombers basically at that point. How do you know which group you're, let's say, covering and not mix it up with some other? If you look on a B-17 and you look at the tail will tell you the group. Mm-hmm. It might be a square. It might be a diamond. It might be a letter. It might be something. The letters for a 55th fighter group was Y something. If you saw a 51 that had the number Y something, it was from the 55th fighter group. Every group had a letter designation.
So most of your missions were escort missions for the bombers.
Oh, yeah, practically everything. But we did a lot of strafing. Once we got the bombers back to friendly territory, depending on our leader, we went back and started strafing fields. We did a lot of strafing. You strafe an airfield, but the way we strafed it, we'd make a pass and then get the hell out of there. You know what I mean? On this day, we were supposed to strafe on the Rhine, but it was really heavy cover. I mean, you couldn't see the ground. What would happen? We'd fly around, we'd find a hole, we'd dive down through the hole, and we did this eventually enough times, and we got down below the level. We were around 600 feet or thereabouts. The guy that was leading us says, okay, get in flight formation, we're going home. I can remember distinctly to this day that when he said we were in friendly territory, let's go home, I thought, I remember Holland and a few of those places which were very close to where he was talking about. And I remember this Tudor 5-2, you sure we're in friendly territory? Yes. It wasn't maybe 2 or 3 minutes later, I get this jut. And I thought, what the hell's wrong? And pretty soon, I could see the tracers coming. We ended up going right over a flak battery. There were two other guys that went down. I didn't know what happened to them. They thought I got killed. They didn't know. Because once that happened, the planes just started scattering. Right away, when I got hit, and it started trying to go and try to. So I said, I got to get out of this plane. I can't. There's no way I can survive if I have to go into these dikes. There's no level ground around here. I got up to as much as I could to 1,000 feet, and I bailed out. And when I hit the ground, the parachute couldn't have been open very long, because the moment I hit the ground, those knees came clear up beyond my face. And I think I was out of it for a while. It was windy. Parachute was being drugged me, and I ended up in a ditch with water. And the moment I hit the water, I came to. But when I came to, I looked up on a bank, and here's a Sherman soldier pointing his gun at me, wanted me to get my hands up in the air. And that was it.
So because you had to bail out so low, the force with which you hit the ground sent your knees into your head and knocked you out.
It really, I don't remember being drugged at all. The only thing I remember is the moment I hit that water, I came to. So I probably might have been out a little bit. I don't know.
And you were probably not too far from getting killed.
Well, there's a possibility.
I mean, you're probably a few seconds here or there, or
yeah.
The timing of it.
I don't know. It could have been very easily. I am going to tell you something. Gus Leslie was on a mission prior to when I went down. I remember when we get back, we talk about our mission, ask questions, and so on. But Gus wasn't in the same group that I was with. He was with a different one. The 343rd would go out, but you'd have 4 or 5 different flights in that particular one. I asked, where's Gus Leslie? Hey, where's Gus Leslie? No one knew. When I got shot down, the German soldier got me up in the air. They took me out into the middle of the, it was just an open area. I remember it was a little bit of rain. The head guy comes out. There's a couple of them standing there, and he's talking. I know that if I was in Japan, I wouldn't be here. That guy could have taken out a gun, bang. No one knew what happened to me. When I finally, eventually, when I tell you, when I got back to the group, talking to the guys and so on, they didn't know. They thought I had got killed and so on. Well, anyway, they put two soldiers with me, and eventually they're going to take me to an interrogation camp. And in interrogation, you're told, you don't have to give them anything but name, rank, and serial number. Then he starts asking you about other things. Where'd you go to school? All this stuff and so on. The guy that interrogated me, he knew so much more about the 8th Air Force than I'll ever know. But before I went to see the interrogator, the guy takes me out of this room. You're in a single room, and I'm walking. And as I'm walking, a door open on my right opens up. You know who it was? Gus Leslie.
What are the odds?
There are no odds. I don't know how you could. As I was walking right there, the door opened, and I said, Gus. And then I thought, God, that's terrible. You better not say anything. But he got away. I mean, he went down. He got shot down, and he was free for several days. And then looking for food and stuff, they finally got him. And then eventually they put him in the interrogation area. But when I stop and think, that day when I was walking, he was had a hold of me, taking me to the interrogator. Gus Leslie comes up. Then it wasn't very long after that they got rid of us and sent us to Stalag 1. We went by train.
And you're a 21-year-old kid, and you don't know how long this war is going to go. You don't know what it is like to be a prisoner. But now you end up in this prison camp. Were you afraid? Did you have any expectation of what was going to happen?
No, I don't think so. I don't even remember being afraid in a situation. There were just a bunch of other people that were there. No one ever mentioned that there was something, they had done something that was, you know, beat somebody or something like that. It was unbelievable. It was just, I can't say that like I was on vacation somewhere.
What about your mom? Did she have any idea what had happened to you? Did she know where you were?
When she first heard, all she got was missing in action. Then, I don't remember whether it was several weeks or a month or so on, the Red Cross was giving names of people that were in prison. Then, somebody there had contacted my mom that I was in prison camp. And that's when the first time that they knew I hadn't been killed, that I was in prison camp. They allowed us to write letters.
Did you ever have days where you weren't sure if you were ever going to experience freedom again?
No. We had a makeshift radio that got news from London every night. We knew where Patton was. We knew where the British were. We knew that the Russians were coming from the opposite end. So it was just a matter of waiting until they got there. The situation got so bad in town. German people came from the town, came to the prison, and asked for protection from the Russians.
Right. I have to imagine that there was a different atmosphere around the camp
in those few days. There's no doubt about it. You know, the Americans were up there. We could leave the camp. They said, maybe it'd be better if you just stay in camp. It'd be, you know, you have no problem. I remember Gus and I and some others, we got out and walked around. What I was hoping, I could find some guy who was fishing so I could borrow his pole. I wanted to fish and so on. I love to fish and so on.
Did you lose any weight while you were there?
Yeah, lost weight. That's the only thing, I lost some weight.
How much?
Probably in the neighborhood of 15, 18 pounds, probably.
Not bad compared to some others I've heard.
I know some people, it was really a problem.
So the camp's liberated, but you guys are still there, and I'm sure there's a little bit of, well, what's going to happen next? And then they fly some bombers in to pick
you
up?
They flew B-17s. It wasn't right away. It was a couple of weeks. But I remember I was right up in front. We flew to Lucky Strike, which was in France. And then it was there that Leslie and I, we went somewhere and got on an airplane, flew back to the base, and went back to our outfit and visited with guys, you know, that we knew and everything else.
Did some of those guys still think you were dead?
Yeah, well, they didn't know that we were in prison. When I got back, there were several of the planes got shot down. And they thought I got killed. They didn't have any idea. You know, when you're young and you're 21 years old, I think a lot of times you think you're indestructible, you know. Once I got over there and we were flying those missions and we were losing people. Every time we went on a mission and we did strafing and things like that, we were losing two or three people every day, you know. You know, I think back on, you know, being over there, the chances of getting killed, who knows?
It's time for our first break, but we have two more World War II era college football players for you to hear from, including one who played after losing a finger in the Marines. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.